Hi, I'm Lauren Gilger, co-host of the show, one of KJZZ's original productions. It's a program with news and features from across Phoenix and the state. You can find much more at theshow.kjzz.org. Here's today's episode.
Good morning. It's the show here on KJZZ 91.5 in Phoenix. I'm Mark Brody.
And I'm Lauren Gilger. Coming up, scientists could be getting closer to a diagnosis for long COVID.
And we look inside the world of black rodeo and meet its first crowned rodeo queen.
But first, the Supreme Court overturned a lower court order yesterday that changes the game when it comes to immigration enforcement across the country. And it's bringing up memories of the SB 1070 era here in Arizona.
The ruling allows federal immigration agents to stop and detain people solely based on their race or ethnicity, or the fact that they're speaking Spanish or have an accent, or because they're sitting outside someplace like a Home Depot waiting for day labor work.
Critics say it's blatant racial profiling that makes anyone with brown skin suspect. But the Trump administration celebrated the ruling as a victory for the rule of law in their mission to carry out the president's mass deportations of undocumented immigrants.
That said, this is a temporary ruling. It means the government can continue to use these tactics in immigration sweeps as the court process plays out. And it is having ripple effects across immigrant communities.
Let's turn now to longtime Arizona civil rights attorney Stephen Montoya to talk about the potential impact of this ruling here. Good morning, Stephen. Thanks for coming on.
Good morning. Thank you.
So what is your reaction to this Supreme Court ruling?
Well, I'm not very happy about it. I'm somewhat surprised by it because this really does overturn, even though it purports not to, long-term precedents that have been governing this area of law really for probably almost three decades. So that's why I'm surprised. Here's why I'm not surprised. Unfortunately, the Supreme Court has really rubber-stamped a series of expansions of executive power and the nationalization of federal law enforcement, and even more troubling, the militarization of national law enforcement. And really, that is something that is virtually unique in American history, and it's especially troubling because one of the reasons why there was a American Revolution and there was a constitutional convention in 1787, and there was a ratification of the Constitution that resulted from the convention, was because of a militaristic foreign police force in America. It was called the English Army, that was really terrorizing the citizens and imposing a dictatorship upon the people. We're not close to a dictatorship upon the people. However, the expansion of federal law enforcement, the militarization of the National Guard, potentially nationally to enforce domestic law, coupled with a president who two terms ago, the United States Supreme Court ruled was immune, criminally immune, he was already civilly immune, from acts done in the scope of his office. All those things combined really do result in a profound change in the constitutional makeup of the United States.
Let me ask you, Stephen, about
sure.
What we're talking about here in Arizona. Like, we're talking about immigration enforcement, racial profiling, and it sounds a lot like the debate around SB 1070 more than a decade ago, which was, you know, largely overturned then by the U.S. Supreme Court. That, of course, had to do with local law enforcement. This has to do with federal immigration agents. But you were involved, obviously, in the litigation against 1070. Are you seeing these similarities?
Yeah, and before that, back in the 90s, I was involved in a lawsuit against the city of Chandler, who conducted a municipal immigration raid in downtown Chandler that was also unconstitutional. Yeah, it is very similar. However, this is worse, because remember, 1070 was a state law, as you pointed out, so it really was confined to Arizona. And Also remember, the United States, the Obama administration sued the state of Arizona. And in United States versus Arizona, the United States Supreme Court said that 1070 was unconstitutional because the state could not just declare itself to have the authority to enforce federal immigration law.
Mm-hmm.
So this is actually worse because this is the federal government doing it, and the federal government is actually doing it not only in Los Angeles, but also in Washington, D.C., and virtually across the country. So it's much broader in scope. And moreover, unlike 1070, really, which it didn't involve the National Guard. See, to federalize the National Guard
mm-hmm.
and to use the National Guard as a police force to enforce immigration law is a very troubling and, in my opinion, dangerous precedent.
So let me ask you about the Trump administration's argument here, though, Stephen. Like, some of the conservative Supreme Court justices who ruled on this say that you can't kind of hang the prospect of being held in contempt of court over these agents as they're trying to do their job, that it's reasonable to allow agents to rely on their experience to sort of target folks who might be undocumented. What do you make of that argument?
Well, I think it has some plausibility, and I personally am against illegal immigration, and I believe that everyone has to obey the law. I can't move to Mexico without seeking the authorization of the Mexican government in advance, and that's the Republic of Mexico's right to keep me out of Mexico. Should it choose to do so. So I support immigration enforcement. However, I also support people's individual rights. And it's true, I read the Justice Kavanaugh's concurring mm-hmm. opinion because, of course, the majority didn't render an opinion.
Right.
They rendered an order without briefing, without oral argument, and without any justification for the order. But I do get it. 10% of the residents of Los Angeles County are undocumented. That is an alarming amount. And it is true that a lot of them are from South America, so a lot of them appear physically to be Latino or Hispanic or Mexican or South American. A lot of them speak Spanish.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of them are manual laborers. A lot of them dress like manual laborers, and a lot of them are undocumented. But unfortunately, for the law and due process, a lot of native-born Americans fall into that category, and Arizona is a great example.
Right.
Part of Douglas is in the United States, and the other half of Douglas is across the street in Mexico. There are a lot of communities in Arizona like that, and there are a lot of native-born citizens who meet all of those characteristics that the Supreme Court has now authorized the federal government to stop and demand proof of citizenship. I was born in Santa Fe, New Mexico. It's the oldest capital in the United States. It's
mm-hmm.
older than Mexico. It's older than the United States. I don't carry around my birth certificate.
Right.
So it's very troubling, and I would ask, are we going to put immigration enforcement above due process? And
right.
I say we should not do that.
All right, we will have to leave it there. That is Arizona civil rights attorney Stephen Montoya joining us to talk about this. Stephen, thank you very much for coming on the show. Appreciate it.
Thank you for having me. Bye.
Millions of people around the world suffer from long COVID, but there's no way to actually diagnose it other than assuming patients displaying symptoms have it. Scientists, though, believe they may have found a way to figure out if a patient suffering from long COVID symptoms actually has the ailment. Researchers at the Translational Genomics Research Institute, or TGen, along with colleagues in California, say they've identified a potential biomarker that could serve as a diagnosis. Dr. Patrick Perotti, associate professor at TGen, is a co-senior author on the study. He joins me to talk more about what they found. And Patrick, what exactly is this biomarker that you've discovered?
Yeah, this biomarker is essentially a protein fragment from a viral protein, so that belongs to the SARS-CoV-2 or COVID virus. And this viral protein is a so-called replicase, and we identified it in vesicles that are secreted by patients that suffer from long COVID.
And so you found this in their blood, but it sounds like, interestingly, not every time you took a patient's blood. Like, am I right that sometimes you found it and sometimes you didn't?
So our initial goal was not to look for COVID-specific proteins in blood. We were interested in assessing the effect of a very mild exercise regimen on improving symptoms of long COVID. And we did observe improvements of the symptoms, so the study itself was successful. But we really wanted to also investigate what was happening in terms of proteins that were changing during that exercise regimen, and if we could actually tie these proteins to these physiological improvements that we had observed. And then this led to a further study where we actually looked for viral proteins being in circulation. And it is correct that we didn't see these viral proteins actually in at every time point in our study. So we collected essentially plasma from participants, and we followed a number of different proteins over time. And sometimes we would see these viral proteins come up, and sometimes they would not be present. And we believe this is due to both the really low abundance of those proteins in blood. And so part of it is just the sensitivity of our methods. And it's also probably related to the fact that participants don't always shed viral proteins, even if they are long COVID patients, are potentially harboring a viral infection. They are not specifically infectious all the time. They're not necessarily producing proteins. And so those proteins don't always show up in blood.
Huh. Did you find any kind of relationship between the number of times that you found the protein in a particular patient and the severity of the long COVID symptoms that that patient exhibited?
So our study was a pilot study in 14 participants that we followed over 3 months. We suspect that that is the case, but we haven't we're just not powered yet to make that claim, but we do suspect that that's the case.
Okay. So what to you is the significance of this? I mean, you mentioned, for example, that, your study incorporated patients who had long COVID symptoms, and that's really the only way that anybody knows they have it, right? Right now they have symptoms. So what would be the significance of actually having maybe a way to say, yes, you have it, or no, you don't?
Today there is no molecular test that accurately helps diagnose patients with long COVID. So long COVID symptoms are usually generalized fatigue, shortness of breath, so we call that dyspnea, or exercise intolerance, and also brain fog, so the inability to focus or concentrate, or just general sluggishness. And those can really persist for months or sometimes even years after a COVID infection. But there is no, those are all physiological symptoms, but they're not necessarily molecular symptoms. So we don't really have a blood test today that can allow us to do that. And I think this study here provides really, I think, a new way of looking at diagnosis of patients with long COVID. And we would like to pursue really the development of potentially a test that would allow us to identify COVID patients. So we do identify certain signatures of those viral proteins, not just specifically in blood, but in what we call extracellular vesicles. And extracellular vesicles are little bubbles, if you want, that package material from all of our cells, and usually those vesicles are secreted by cells, and cells use that to communicate with each other. But if those cells are infected with a virus, well, they will potentially also contain viral proteins. So those vesicles can carry proteins, genetic material, and other signals. And I think the idea that we can isolate then those vesicles and tap into what's happening into individual cells just by a simple blood draw makes this very attractive as a diagnostic approach.
Is it possible that any of that might help lead to a treatment for long COVID?
Yeah, absolutely. During the course of their infection, patients with long COVID seem to harbor viral particles in their cells, but they're not necessarily producing proteins and secreting the actual virus. And this is what we call a reservoir or COVID reservoir, where essentially the virus is dormant and hidden in our body. And only during some specific time frame will this virus, for instance, produce viral particles that will be infectious. And I think the fact that we were able to measure these viruses as cargo in those extracellular vesicles in blood actually tells us that the life cycle of the virus is actually pretty complex, and it's doesn't always stay hidden. And I think that's probably a good time point when we can hit it with a certain therapeutic regimen. We do have a regimen of therapeutics available to us today. So I think understanding better that maybe those patients should be treated, continuously treated with effective drugs at the time where they're actually secreting those viral particles may be the way to go.
I was going to ask you about that because obviously there are treatments that some patients get. It sounds like it's your expectation that at least for some number of patients, those treatments, those existing treatments, will continue to be effective.
They will most likely continue to be effective, but viruses are really good at evading our common therapies. So I would expect that COVID or SARS-CoV-2 will also adapt and find ways to potentially remain hidden in some of our cells. And so I think targeting those cells and generating or developing targeted therapies for those patient populations that suffer from COVID, where the virus has potentially adapted to remain hidden, will be necessary.
Dr. Patrick Perotti is an associate professor at the Translational Genomics Research Institute, or TGen.
Good morning. It is the show here on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Lauren Gilger.
And I'm Mark Brody. Coming up, a new documentary follows WNBA star Diana Taurasi beyond the court.
The part that I really had to dig deep to get from her was all the moments that we don't see in the highlights, that we don't see in those media interviews after a game or at the Olympics. And that was like what happens behind the scenes, what happens in those low moments. How did that affect her? How did she feel?
We'll hear from the director of the three-part docuseries, but first...
Samira Miller has been around horses for most of her life, but it wasn't until recently that she took that experience into the ring to compete in the first Miss Black Rodeo USA competition. And she won. Last month, she was crowned in the inaugural pageant.
Once again, Miss Lynette Campbell from Black Rodeo USA and Foundation awarding our new queen for 2025. Watch her, she's proud.
Born and raised here in Arizona, Miller's not just good with a horse. She has degrees in clinical nutrition and regenerative agriculture and runs Alchemy Farms in Gilbert, where she farms and teaches workshops on farming, gardening, and its connections to her community's roots. Her social media proclaims, "I am my ancestors' wildest dreams." And those roots go deep. Miller's family can be traced back to the first Black cowboys in Texas, and that is where we began our conversation.
My mother's side of the family, I'm a descendant of the Cartwright brothers, who were previously enslaved Africans in St. Augustine, Texas. We got hold of that deed, I want to say, in 2018. But I come from country folk on both sides of the family. So on my mother's side, we've always kind of been around it. And for me, kind of getting into this space, I think it's just like a reclamation and rematriation to what my ancestors were doing and trying to just change the narrative more or less.
So you grew up in an agricultural kind of world?
To some extent, yeah. I was also a collegiate athlete, so I kind of had some space between that. But I did grow up rodeoing, took a break from it a little bit, always had a garden with my dad, and yeah.
Let me ask you about rodeoing in general, because I think making the verb is going to be confusing to some people. What does it mean? Like, what did it mean, for example, when you were a kid? What did you do?
I was a CVSC rodeo queen. They're located out of Queen Creek. So in that, when I first started riding, which was around 9 years old, kind of just started some introductory lessons, Western lessons. So anything from like tacking your horse up, picking their feet out, just getting more comfortable, being around a bigger from that perspective.
Yeah.
Then kind of the following years afterwards, got into more intermediate and advanced riding skills. So trot, lope, canter, there's very different aspects of things that you could call it, but more or less just getting more comfortable knowing how to have adequate horsemanship.
Mm-hmm.
And then I think I was around 11-ish is when I first did my first ever Gymkhana. So that was a combination of barrel racing, pole bending, and they usually have like a specialty event. So yeah, I did that for about 3-4 seasons and then kind of just not necessarily hobby horsing, but so I've always been around it is basically what I'm trying to say. Yeah.
But you competed, you won some titles.
Yeah.
But it was mostly for fun, it sounds like.
It was mostly
like.
For fun.
You went to college then and studied something that ended up in your master's program at least being pretty relevant to what it is that you do now. Tell us about that.
So my undergraduate degree is actually in human biology. Mm-hmm. So I was pre-med. Really, I've always just been interested in, like, the body and how it works and things from that perspective. And then I got my first master's is in clinical nutrition. With that, I kind of just really wanted to understand, like, how nutrition played a role in human health, which then led me down another rabbit hole of agriculture. I somewhere along the line got a hold of a soil panel in comparison to a human blood panel. And I was like, oh, wow, we're testing for the same things. So I really just have been interested in, you know, the environment, human health, and I really just wanted to create change from that level. I really just started looking at soil. I was like, oh my gosh, like, what are we spraying on soil? How are people getting access to this? How are people getting access to fresh fruits and vegetables? What does equity look like from that aspect?
Let me ask you about the other strand in your life here, which is the rodeo. Okay.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah.
So you started off as a kid participating in rodeo, competing. Sometimes you go to college, you become, you know, an expert in farming and these practices that sort of bring you back to your roots in a lot of ways. Mm-hmm. Where do these things come together for you? Did that happen when you found out about Black Rodeo?
Yeah, I actually got a hold of one of the members from the Flying Crows, which is a horsemanship organization. And I was like, okay, I feel like we could bridge this with like ag and with rodeo aspects because these are all things that our ancestors were doing. For me, I want to be able to merge the two, you know, even from a land management perspective, since I have certifications in holistic management, like what if we're able to grow feed for the animals? You know, maybe it's not necessarily that you're having to go buy XYZ bales or huge astronomical amounts of bales. You can grow it on your own property, but that also takes in consideration what does access look like? And I think for Black Rodeo specifically, the organization started because we wanted to highlight a space for Black riders because, you know, historically, the word cowboy comes from, it's in a derogatory term that's oriented towards enslaved Africans. So, you know, we have a way of incorporating more or less a change of narrative. I think that we don't have to, in the Black community, we don't have to have a negative relationship with it. And I think he's doing a great job of trying to increase visibility for it. But this is also something that we've been doing.
Yeah.
And it's something that's not maybe as recognized like on the West, but like in the East and South areas. Like, it's not to say that we don't have it out here, but we've been here. We've always been here. We just haven't had the recognition for
it. Right. Like, you think of a cowboy in the Wild West and you think of like a, you know, like a white guy in a cowboy hat riding a horse. But you're saying in parts of the South, especially, like, the vision of a cowboy might be very different.
Mm-hmm.
That's really cool.
Mm-hmm.
Let me ask you about when you were a kid competing in rodeo. Were you the only one who looked like you?
Yeah, for CVSC, I was the only little brown girl out there. I didn't really have to deal with any, like, racial situations in the organization that I was participating in, they really were aware and they made sure that I didn't have to deal with anything with that. They always checked people if there was a situation that came up, but I didn't necessarily have to deal with that. And that's not to invalidate anybody else's experience. For me, I was one of one in my organization. So, you know, on both sides of the family, I've had folks that have rode horses. You know, it was just something that I was brought into or grew up in. I think with what's going on right now, folks are really wanting to get into rodeo and be aware of like how to incorporate that in their lifestyle. I think it's a beautiful thing for the Black community.
Yeah. Okay. So tell us about the pageant. I mean, like, this is the first one there's been. What does it consist of when you go to do something like this?
So we had a series of personal interviews. We had a horsemanship portion where we did a reining pattern. We also had modeling and speeches that we had to do.
Okay, so the horsemanship in there, but other than that, it's kind of like a pageant you might think of otherwise.
It's a pageant. Mm-hmm.
What did it feel like to compete in this and have it be, you know, a Black rodeo? This is from Miss Black Rodeo USA.
It was awesome. I think that this is really cool. I think that for me, it's honestly a great honor to be the first inaugural, especially with the historical context of things. You know, I think it's time that we, you know, show folks that we've always been a part of this and we're going to continue to keep being a part of it. And I think having the platform to be the face for the organization is something that I hold with a level of pride, because this is overall creating a level of legacy for us. So,
right. You think of it as a legacy moment,
it
sounds like.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so you're on this kind of whirlwind tour as the winner here. What message are you hoping to get out there? Are you meeting, like, you know, little girls at these events who are looking at you and going, I want to do this?
Yes, ma'am.
That's so cool.
So I really just want to create representation for young Black girls to know that they can do it too. You know, sometimes we, in the Black community, we've been disenfranchised. There's been financial barriers, historic barriers. We're really just trying to create a space to invite these kids in to know that if this is something that they truly want to pursue, they can. And I think that's where this representation starts, with them seeing folks that look like them. So trying to create that space for them.
So do you feel like this is kind of a coming together of your two lives, right? Like, of this kind of farming initiative, this education initiative around foods and soil and the, you know, the ways in which we're nourishing our bodies, mm-hmm. and doing this kind of public facing thing as the first Miss Black Rodeo USA. Like, you talked about the disenfranchisement of Black communities in terms of not having those healthy foods, living in food deserts. Is this all coming together for you here?
Oh, yeah. Originally, when I started my business, it was really, I wanted to just do things for the community because I recognize that there's a need. So I think having the vocal platform and also showing people that they can do these things is something that I'm really looking forward to increasing visibility for.
All right. Samira Miller is the first inaugural Miss Black Rodeo USA, also the farmer and owner of Alchemy Farms in Gilbert, joining us. Samira, thank you so much for coming in. I really appreciate it.
Awesome. Thank you so much.
Good morning. It is the show here on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Lauren Gilger.
And I'm Mark Brody. The Japanese Film Festival kicks off this weekend in Mesa at ASU's Mix Center. The festival will feature a mix of features and short films. One of the shorts is called Yuri. It tells the story of a Black Russian weightlifter named Yuri who lives in a small American suburb. Yuri's imposing physical stature and his limited English make it difficult for him to relate to his neighbors and coworkers. But one day, he meets an older Japanese widow named Hiroko. She takes a liking to Yuri and invites him over for sake in her cluttered living room, which is crammed with flowers and artifacts from her past. As they talk, they find themselves opening up in unexpected ways. Yuri is co-written and directed by filmmaker Johnny Hobbs. He spoke with our co-host, Sam Dingman.
So, Johnny, to start, tell me where the idea for this film came from. You've chosen two characters that I personally don't think I've really seen on screen before.
Yeah, right. I mean, I guess that's the point, is that these two people, this Black Russian, which generally is 1% of the Russian population, and then you have this older Japanese woman who, it's not directly said, but, you know, had a wife or had a partner that was a woman. The point was to make sure that the people that we can assume don't exist or we don't even think of don't need to necessarily find like-minded individuals in their community to connect with. That's good, but you can also find people that have no discernible connection or visible connection to you, and you can find people that still see you.
Yeah, yeah. Well, there's a line in the film that Yuri, the Black Russian weightlifter, he says to Hiroko,
"They see what I look like, but not me."
I got the sense, and I'm inferring here, that for both of them, whether it's people who they might think they would have natural community with, or just the general world of America, it seems like until the events that we see in this film, nobody has really seen the other one quite as clearly as they do for each other, with the exception probably of Hiroko's partner who passed away.
Yeah, nobody in the world, and this is beyond the movie, but nobody is seeing anybody for who they truly are until they get to really sit down and talk to them. And even then it can be kind of muddled. And look, the movie that I made is extremely idealistic, you know? So, you know, it's in a perfect world, these two people come together and they sort of understand one another. But we're all sort of living in our own bubble until we decide to really listen and take in somebody.
Okay. Well, can I ask you about, there is a real specificity culturally to both Yuri's character and Hiroko's character, as you were pointing out. What was interesting to you about bringing those two specific cultural identities together?
Well, the reason why I decided over time to make Yuri a Black Russian comes from a lot of different things. Personal stuff about me being a Black American in America, being a dark-skinned Black American male in America, and how I can be perceived or misperceived just by my existence.
Can I ask you quickly about that? Because, and not to assume, but that makes me think about the opening scene of the film where Yuri is getting a massage and it's not going the way that he wants it to. And he sort of like objects to the way that the massage therapist is touching him. And she completely freaks out and goes to get her husband, who comes in with a bat, like Yuri was threatening to attack her, which is absolutely not the case. And Yuri has to take a deep breath and make it very clear to them that he's not a threat. Is that part of what you're referring to there?
Yeah, so you know, my co-writer and I, Aviv Rubinstein, I think the thing that we both wanted was for him to a moment to feel sexualized, to feel outside of his own body like an alien, and to feel put upon or accused of something that he didn't do.
Okay.
And these have been things that have happened in my life in many different ways and have, frankly, I'm sure for you too, Sam, in your own existence, in your own body, have happened to you.
Absolutely.
Just because I am an African American living in America, I don't have a stamp on being misunderstood.
Yeah.
I think that's what I was trying to make sure that I was opening up the conversation, that it wasn't just about Black Americans, that it was, we have this idea as Americans of what a Russian looks like on film.
Yes.
Villains, mischievous or deceitful individuals, maybe they drink a lot.
That makes me think about the sequences in the film where we see Yuri, he has this notebook that he carries around where he's written down these like practice conversational phrases. And I realize some of that is because English is not his first language, but I don't know. It just reminds me of the way that he seems so obsessed with trying to figure out what is the right way to come across. How do I make people not be threatened by me, unnerved by me?
Yeah. Complete anxiety about something, you know, where you're trying to be so perfect that you end up sort of fumbling, you know, and it's not your problem.
Can I ask you then also about, there's a couple of things that we see both Yuri and Hiroko be interested in that, to my mind as a viewer, were very, not to overuse this phrase, but culturally specific traditions that are frequently misappropriated. One of them being yoga, which we see Yuri doing with a yoga teacher who's literally looking at his phone the whole time he's running the class.
Yeah.
And the other being Ikebana, the Japanese flower arranging tradition, which Hiroko clearly has a very profound relationship with.
Arrangements thrive when their beauty is fully acknowledged. This dance is a discipline that creates an act of love towards you, the flower, and your surroundings.
Ikebana is about self-expression within discipline.
Yes, that makes sense. And it makes me think about another one of my favorite lines is, I believe it's Hiroko who says this as she's talking to Yuri about her Ikebana work. She says, any unnecessary parts of the flower should be cut so that the artist can flourish and grow. It's a really lovely idea. But it also strikes me that in a way, that is kind of what Yuri helps Hiroko do in the film, is to keep the memory of her partner alive in the home, but not need there to be all these cluttered physical artifacts there that might be blocking her a little bit.
You're right, but let me tell you this also. She is helping him with the same thing. The words that she is saying are directly connected to his life.
Yes.
The yoga class, the massage therapist. Why do we have these people in our lives?
Mm-hmm.
Why do we have people that are bringing us down or not willing to listen to us?
Right.
Why are they existing in anybody's life? We don't need it. Let's cut it out.
Well, Johnny Hobbs is the filmmaker of the film we've been talking about, which will be screening at the Japanese Film Festival here on September 12th and 13th, and the film Yuri. Johnny, thank you so much for this conversation.
Sam, thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate your time, man. Thank you so much.
Good morning. It's the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Lauren Gilger.
And I'm Mark Brody. In honor of the WNBA's 25th anniversary season in 2021, the league asked fans to name the GOAT, the greatest of all time. The winner, Diana Taurasi of the Phoenix Mercury. For a lot of fans and watchers of women's basketball, the honor wasn't much of a surprise.
She's the best to ever do it, ever.
She was like, I'm just going to win no matter what it takes.
The biggest moments are her best moments.
That's Dee's superpower.
That's from the trailer for a new three-part series called Taurasi. It's currently streaming on Prime Video. By way of a quick recap, Taurasi played 20 seasons in the WNBA, all of them in Phoenix. She retired as the league's all-time leading scorer. She was the top overall pick in the 2004 draft after winning three straight NCAA titles at UConn. She's won WNBA championships, Olympic gold medals, MVPs, and a bunch of other titles and awards. But the series doesn't necessarily focus on all of that. Katie Bender-Wynn, a filmmaker and Taurasi's director, says she wanted to tell a more character-driven story.
I hadn't heard of Diana Taurasi before, actually. Growing up as an athlete in Australia, the WNBA wasn't on our screens, so I didn't really know a lot about her. And I did some Googling, and obviously her Wikipedia page is so long, you know, full of accolades. But then there's obviously some interesting points that came up. One of them, obviously, she'd been known to be villainized. And, you know, another one was that she was a talker. And so for someone who wasn't aware of this world, I didn't really, you know, understand the meaning behind it. I thought it was interesting. I was, as a filmmaker, very fascinated by that and wanted to understand, you know, the meaning of why she was being labeled that, which I think once you get to know Diana, there are, I think, misconceptions and misunderstandings about her career.
One of the other things that a lot of people will say about Diana Taurasi is that she is kind of famously camera shy. Like, she doesn't love talking, especially about herself. I wonder if it was kind of a tough sell to get her to agree to do this.
Yeah, I mean, look, I think, you know, she obviously was already willing to do this project before it had come to me. So I think for her, it was about finding the right director. And I think she was, you know, ready to open up, but it obviously was just going to take the right person.
She has had, as you referenced, such a decorated career from high school to college to the WNBA to the Olympics to playing overseas. When you talked to her, what did she have to say about sort of the totality of her career and I guess all the winning and success that she had during it?
You know, that's an interesting question because I would say the way that I began this process with her was not talking about all the accolades, you know, like, cause she's won the accolades and they're written on paper. And it's like, she's not really one to just sit down and talk about the highlights. And that was one of the things she said to me. She didn't want this to be a highlights reel.
Hmm.
The part that I really had to dig deep to get from her was all the moments that we don't see in the highlights, that we don't see in those media interviews after a game or at the Olympics. And that was like what happens behind the scenes, what happens in those low moments, how did that affect her? How did she feel?
How similar or dissimilar is the Diana Taurasi off the court to the Diana Taurasi that so many of us have seen on the court?
I laugh at that because, you know, obviously when I saw some of these videos of her screaming at refs and getting pissed off, I was, you know, naturally terrified. But, you know, when I was with her, yeah, it was all laughs. You know, we got along great. And I think getting to know her as a person first, as opposed to having this like preconception of like her career over the last 20 years, I think that helped. I think that did help a lot because I just got to know the other side of her.
Did she talk about pressure in terms of needing to be the best or feeling like others were depending on her or her teammates were depending on her? Like, I would just think that if you are labeled the greatest of all time in anything, that's got to come with some expectations and some amount of pressure, right?
Yeah, look, I think in her closing statements in episode 3, in the very end, she says that she's ready to not fight anymore. Like there's always been this inner fight in her mind, and what she means by that is the pressure of leading a team, the pressure of winning, all those things that she has held as one of the greats, ready to let go of that. And I found that line really, really powerful.
Did she say led her to that? Like what led her to sort of be ready to let go?
You know, it's funny. I mean, obviously, like she was, you know, 42 and to be playing the way she is playing is, you know, you're at the end of your basketball career. Like that's when your body's starting to slow down.
Yeah.
And you know, for her, I think that she had come to a place in her mind where she was ready to have coffee with her wife and take her kids to preschool. Like she didn't want to be traveling and leaving her family. And yeah, I mean, she was just, I think she was ready for a long time. It was just more about like, at what point was the right time for her? And I do wonder if she was waiting out to go to that 6th Olympics.
How does she look at her time in the WNBA, especially because it ended at such an interesting time when, you know, the league was, it had been popular with her in it, obviously, but it really seemed to take off to a new level with Caitlin Clark and Angel Reese and now Paige Becker's coming up, that I wonder what she had to say about her role sort of helping build up the WNBA and then leaving it seemingly as it's almost going to another level.
I mean, that's crazy. I mean, it's almost poetic in a way. I think what a lot of people don't understand, which I hope this doc is, you know, the vehicle for other people to now know that if it wasn't for Diana carrying the league for a really rough time, there probably wouldn't be a league right now. And she truly is a game changer. And all the sacrifices that she took in those years where the league was shaky is, you know, why we are where we are today.
After having gotten to know her like you have and talking to her as much as you did, what do you think is Diana Taurasi's legacy, not just in the WNBA, but in women's basketball broadly and maybe even in women's sports more broadly than that?
Yeah, I think that a big part of Diana's legacy is that We grew up in a generation in women's sports where everyone just tried to fit the mold. Like we grew up in a generation where society wanted or expected female athletes to look and act a certain way. And Diana didn't fit that mold, but she didn't conform to that mold. And that's why I admire her so much, because especially in a world now where society and athletes are like craving authenticity, and it is, you know, the way we're marketing things now is to be true to yourself. She was that her entire career. And, you know, I think in that generation, not a lot of female athletes were doing that, because they were just saying yes to anything that came along just to try to get their name out there, because that's what you did, right? But she was okay with saying no, because at the end of the day, she was the best bowler in the world and she knew her worth. And so the power of no, I think, now resonates so powerfully. And I think that, you know, you're educated with that part of her story after watching this doc. And I hope that, and I know that actually some of the current athletes in the WNBA are already thanking her for doing that and are recognizing that. So I think that's a big part of her legacy.
Katie Bender-Winn is an LA-based filmmaker and director of the new three-part series called Taurasi, currently streaming on Prime Video.
All right, that's it for today's edition of the show. We will, of course, be back with you again tomorrow morning with much more. And it's coming up. We are putting the show live on stage. It is this Sunday, September 14th at Crescent Ballroom. We would love to see you there. It's going to be a fun one, Mark. I'm sure you're ready.
Very ready.
You're getting excited. All right, come on out if you can. Go to rsvp.kjzz.org. for more info. And don't forget to follow us on Instagram. We are at KJZZ The Show. For Mark Brody and Sam Dingman, I'm Lauren Gilger. Thanks for joining us.
That's it for this episode of The Show podcast. To find out more about the stories from today or other episodes, visit theshow.kjzz.org. And you can subscribe to KJZZ's The Show on your favorite podcasting site. I'm Mark Brody. Thanks for listening today.